Chapter 10. Thousand in the compass of one single ear. In the room in which these are received, you may see against the wall a box, on which it is written, that it has been calculated, that if every grateful mother who brings a child there will drop a penny into it, the hospital funds may possibly be increased in a year by so large a sum as £40. And you may read in the hospital report, with a glow of pleasure, that these poor women are so respondent, as to have made, even in a toiling year of difficulty and high prices, this estimated £40-£50. In the printed papers of this same hospital, you may read with what a generous earnestness the highest and wisest members of the medical profession testify to the great need of it, to the immense difficulty of treating children in the same hospitals with grown-up people, by reason of their different ailments and requirements, to the vast amount of pain that will be assuaged, and of life that will be saved, through this hospital, not only among the poor, observe, but among the prosperous too, by reason of the increased knowledge of children's illnesses, which cannot fail to arise from a more systematic mode of studying them. Lastly, gentlemen, and I am sorry to say, worst of all, for I must present no rose-colored picture of this place to you, I must not deceive you. Lastly, the visitor to this children's hospital, reckoning up the number of its beds, will find himself perforce obliged to stop at very little over 30, and will learn, with sorrow and surprise, that even that small number, so forlornly, so miserably diminutive, compared with this vast London, cannot possibly be maintained, unless the hospital be made better known. I limit myself to saying better known, because I will not believe that in a Christian community of fathers and mothers, and brothers and sisters, it can fail, being better known, to be well and richly endowed. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this, without a word of adornment which I resolved when I got up not to allow myself, this is the simple case. This is the pathetic case which I have to put to you, not only on behalf of the thousands of children who annually die in this great city, but also on behalf of the thousands of children who live half-developed, racked with preventable pain, shorn of their natural capacity for health and enjoyment. If these innocent creatures cannot move you for themselves, how can I possibly hope to move you in their name? The most delightful paper, the most charming essay, which the tender imagination of Charles Lamb conceived, represents him as sitting by his fireside on a winter night telling stories to his own dear children, and delighting in their society, until he suddenly comes to his old, solitary, bachelor self, and finds that they were but dream children who might have been, but never were. We are nothing, they say to him, less than nothing, and dreams. We are only what might have been, and we must wait upon the tedious shore of Leith, millions of ages, before we have existence and a name. And immediately awaking, he says, I found myself in my armchair. The dream children whom I would now raise, if I could, before every one of you, according to your various circumstances, should be the dear child you love, the dear child you have lost, the child you might have had, the child you certainly have been. Each of these dream children should hold in its powerful hand one of the little children now lying in the child's hospital, or now shut out of it to perish. Each of these dream children should say to you, oh, help this little suppliant in my name. Oh, help it for my sake. Well, and immediately awaking, you should find yourselves in the Freemasons' Hall, happily arrived at the end of a rather long speech, drinking prosperity to the hospital for sick children, and thoroughly resolved that it shall flourish. Speech. Edinburgh, March 26, 1858. On the above date Mr. Dickens gave a reading of his Christmas Carol in the Music Hall, before the members and subscribers of the Philosophical Institution. At the conclusion of the reading the Lord Provost of Edinburgh presented him with a massive silver wassail cup. Mr. Dickens acknowledged the tribute as follows. My Lord Provost, ladies and gentlemen, I beg to assure you I am deeply sensible of your kind welcome, and of this beautiful and great surprise. and that I thank you cordially with all my heart. I never have forgotten, and I never can forget, that I have the honor to be a Burgess and Guild brother of the Corporation of Edinburgh. As long as 16 or 17 years ago, the first great public recognition and encouragement I ever received was bestowed on me in this generous and magnificent city, in this city, so distinguished in literature, and so distinguished in the arts. You will readily believe that I have carried into the various countries I have since traversed, and through all my subsequent career, the proud and affectionate remembrance of that eventful epoch in my life, and that coming back to Edinburgh is to me like coming home. Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard so much of my voice tonight that I will not inflict on you the additional task of hearing any more. I am better reconciled to limiting myself to these very few words, because I know and feel full well that no amount of speech to which I could give utterance could possibly express my sense of the honor and distinction you have conferred on me, or the heartfelt gratification I derive from this reception. Speech. London, March 29, 1858.
At the 13th anniversary festival of the General Theatrical Fund, held at the Freemasons Tavern, at which Thackeray presided, Mr. Dickens made the following speech.
In our theatrical experience as playgoers, we are all equally accustomed to predict by certain little signs and portents on the stage what is going to happen there. When the young lady, an admiral's daughter, is left alone to indulge in a short soliloquy, uncertain smart spirit rappings are heard to proceed immediately from beneath her feet, we foretell that a song is impending. When two gentlemen enter, for whom, by a happy coincidence, two chairs, and no more, are in waiting, we augur a conversation, and that it will assume a retrospective biographical character. When any of the performers who belong to the seafaring or marauding professions are observed to arm themselves with very small swords to which are attached very large hilts, we predict that the affair will end in a combat. Carrying out the association of ideas, it may have occurred to some that, when I asked my old friend in the chair to allow me to propose a toast, I had him in my eye, and I have him now on my lips. The duties of a trustee of the Theatrical Fund, an office which I hold, are not so frequent or so great as its privileges. He is in fact a mere walking gentleman, with the melancholy difference that he has no one to love. If this advantage could be added to his character, it would be one of a more agreeable nature than it is, and his forlorn position would be greatly improved. His duty is to call every half year at the banker's, when he signs his name in a large, creasy, inconvenient book, to certain documents of which he knows nothing, and then he delivers it to the property man and exits anywhere. He, however, has many privileges. It is one of his privileges to watch the steady growth of an institution in which he takes great interest. It is one of his privileges to bear his testimony to the prudence, the goodness, the self-denial, and the excellence of a class of persons who have been too long depreciated, and whose virtues are too much denied, out of the depths of an ignorant and stupid superstition. And lastly, it is one of his privileges sometimes to be called on to propose the health of the chairman at the annual dinners of the institution, when that chairman is one for whose genius he entertains the warmest admiration, and whom he respects as a friend, and as one who does honor to literature, and in whom literature is honored. I say when that is the case, he feels that this last privilege is a great and high one. From the earliest days of this institution, I have ventured to impress on its managers that they would consult its credit and success by choosing its chairman as often as possible within the circle of literature and the arts, and I will venture to say that no similar institution has been presided over by so many remarkable and distinguished men. I am sure, however, that it never has had, and that it never will have, simply because it cannot have, a greater luster cast upon it than by the presence of the noble English writer who fills the chair tonight. It is not for me at this time, and in this place, to take on myself to flutter before you the well-thumbed pages of Mr. Thackeray's books, and to tell you to observe how full they are of wit and wisdom, how outspeaking, and how devoid of fear or favor. But I will take leave to remark, in paying my due homage and respect to them, that it is fitting that such a writer and such an institution should be brought together. Every writer of fiction, although he may not adopt the dramatic form, writes in effect for the stage. He may never write plays, but the truth and passion which are in him must be more or less reflected in the great mirror which he holds up to nature. Actors, managers, and authors are all represented in this company, and it may be supposed that they all have studied the deep wants of the human heart in many theaters. But none of them could have studied its mysterious workings in any theater to greater advantage than in the bright and airy pages of Vanity Fair. To this skillful showman, who has so often delighted us, and who has charmed us again tonight, we have now to wish Godspeed, and that he may continue for many years,
11,
to exercise his potent art. To him fill a bumper toast, and fervently utter, God bless him. Speech. London, April 29, 1858.
The reader will already have observed that in the Christmas week of 1853, and on several subsequent occasions, Mr. Dickens had read the Christmas Carol and the chimes before public audiences, but always in aid of the funds of some institution, or for other benevolent purposes. The first reading he ever gave for his own benefit took place on the above date, in St. Martin's Hall, now converted into the Queen's Theatre.
This reading Mr. Dickens prefaced with the following speech. Ladies and gentlemen, it may perhaps be unknown to you that, for a few years past, I have been accustomed occasionally to read some of my shorter books to various audiences, in aid of a variety of good objects, and at some charge to myself, both in time and money. It having at length become impossible in any reason to comply with these always accumulating demands, I have had definitively to choose between now and then reading on my own account, as one of my recognized occupations, or not reading at all. I have had little or no difficulty in deciding on the former course. The reasons that have led me to it, besides the consideration that it necessitates no departure whatever from the chosen pursuits of my life, are threefold. Firstly, I have satisfied myself that it can involve no possible compromise of the credit and independence of literature. Secondly, I have long held the opinion, and have long acted on the opinion, that in these times, whatever brings a public man and his public face to face, on terms of mutual confidence and respect, is a good thing. Thirdly, I have had a pretty large experience of the interest my hearers are so generous as to take in these occasions, and of the delight they give to me, as a tried means of strengthening those relations, I may almost say of personal friendship, which it is my great privilege and pride, as it is my great responsibility, to hold with a multitude of persons who will never hear my voice, nor see my face. Thus it is that I come, quite naturally, to be here among you at this time, and thus it is that I proceed to read this little book, quite as composedly as I might proceed to write it, or to publish it in any other way. Speech. London, May 1, 1858.
The following short speech was made at the banquet of the Royal Academy, after the health of Mr. Dickens and Mr. Thackeray had been proposed by the President, Sir Charles Eastlick.
Following the order of your toast, I have to take the first part in the duet, to be performed in acknowledgement of the compliment you have paid to literature. In this home of art I feel it to be too much an interchange of compliments, as it were, between near relations, to enter into any lengthened expression of our thanks for the honor you have done us. I feel that it would be changing this splendid assembly into a sort of family party. I may, however, take leave to say that your sister, whom I represent, is strong and healthy, that she has a very great affection for, and an undying interest in you, and that it is always a very great gratification to her to see herself so well remembered within these walls, and to know that she is an honored guest at your hospitable board. Speech. London, July 21, 1858.
On the above date, a public meeting was held at the Princess's Theatre, for the purpose of establishing the now famous Royal Dramatic College. Mr. Charles Keane was the chairman, and Mr. Dickens delivered the following speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think I may venture to congratulate you beforehand on the pleasant circumstance that the movers and seconders of the resolutions which will be submitted to you will, probably, have very little to say. Through the report which you have heard read, and through the comprehensive address of the chairman, the cause which brings us together has been so very clearly stated to you, that it can stand in need of very little, if of any further exposition. But, as I have the honor, to move the first resolution with this handsome gift, and the vigorous action that must be taken upon it, necessitate, I think I shall only give expression to what is uppermost in the general mind here, if I venture to remark that, many as the parts are in which Mr. Keane has distinguished himself on these boards, he has never appeared in one in which the large spirit of an artist, the feeling of a man, and the grace of a gentleman, have been more admirably blended than in this day's faithful adherence to the calling, of which he is a prosperous ornament, and in this day's manly advocacy of its cause. Ladies and gentlemen, the resolution entrusted to me is that the report of the Provisional Committee be adopted, and that this meeting joyfully accepts, and gratefully acknowledges, the gift of 5 acres of land referred to in the said report.
12.
It is manifest, I take it, that we are all agreed upon this acceptance and acknowledgement, and that we all know very well that this generous gift can inspire but one sentiment in the breast of every lover of the dramatic art. As it is far too often forgotten by those who are indebted to it for many a restorative flight out of this working day world, that the silks, and velvets, and elegant costumes of its professors, must be every night exchanged for the hideous coats and waistcoats of the present day, in which we have now the honor, and the misfortune of appearing before you, so when we do meet with a nature so considerably generous as this donor's, and do find an interest in the real life, and struggles of the people who have delighted it, so very spontaneous, and so very liberal, we have nothing to do but to accept and to admire. We have no duty left but to take the goods the gods provide us, and to make the best and the most of them. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to remark that in this mode of turning a good gift to the highest account lies the truest gratitude. In reference to this, I could not but reflect, whilst Mr. Keane was speaking, that in an hour or two from this time, the spot upon Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.